From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Master painter and printmaker Francisco Goya lived through the Napoleonic Wars. He chronicled the barbarity of war, the upheaval of his time, the dark side of humanity. His works feel very relevant right now. His darker subjects, execution, cruelty, torture, disarray, too familiar today. This hour on Point, Francisco Goya on war, upheaval, and humanity's dark side. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on, with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, with horrific images in the newspapers every day. Is it time to look again at Goya? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Stephanie Stepanek, curator of prints and drawings at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, where she's co-curator of the new exhibit, Goya, Order and Disorder, the largest Goya retrospective in the United States in 25 years, with 170 paintings, prints, and drawings. It's on right now, part of a surge of interest in Goya around the world. Stephanie Stepanek, thank you very much for being here today.
Hello, Tom, and I'm delighted to join you here in the BUI studios.
It's great to have you. And with me from Newark, Delaware, is Janice Tomlinson, Director of University Museums at the University of Delaware, Goya historian, biographer. She's curated exhibits on Goya at the Prado in Madrid and has written deeply for the MFA's Order and Disorder catalog. Janice Tomlinson, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
And listeners listening along with us, you can link to a terrific gallery of Goya's work at our website as we speak at onpointradio.org. Stephanie, I have to start by thanking you for a terrific tour of this wonderful exhibit at the MFA last week. Thank you very much for taking me through. What a pleasure that was.
Well, it was great fun to visit the show with you, too. I always learn from my visitors. We had some great conversations, and I encourage other Bostonians and beyond to come and see the show at the MFA.
Janice Tomlinson, I have to say, there are a couple things about Goya that I had not really focused on. First of all, like many others, I knew a lot of his famous and dark work. I mean, you think of Goya, for me, you think of the 3rd of May, the painting with the you've got soldiers, it looks like maybe a back street or a town square. They've got their 18th century, early 19th rifles leveled at a group of guys, a bunch of them dying already, and the one man in the midst in his white blouse shirt with his arms mm-hmm. thrown in the air. I think of that dark disarray, violence. I didn't know the side that was more courtly, the paintings of aristocrats and kings just hadn't really made their impression on me. But it left me wondering, and I've read some, but I hope you'll share with us, the facts of this time, that in his lifetime, his long lifetime, 82 years, turned Goya from, you know, the guy painting these sort of frolicky, what do they call them, cartoon prints on which tapestries would be made, to the artist showing some of the most gruesome, horrific, dark human behavior and response that we can imagine. What was going on in his time that opened that dark path to him, Janice?
Well, many things were going on in his time, and this is the period of the French Revolution. And the French Revolution had repercussions in Spain. When the French king was killed, that was the cousin of the Spanish king.
And Louis XVI goes down, and the echo is heard very loudly in Spain.
That is exactly correct. And so you have a reaction in Spanish society and in Spanish politics. You go from, you know, a sort of balanced absolute monarchy to a more divided political world where you have rising, you know, reformers who are increasingly identified with French influences versus more conservatives identified with the Spanish tradition.
Reformers, course, as in reforming against absolute monarchy, reforming against the church and Inquisition and the darker side there?
No. Not against the Inquisition, yes. Against absolute monarchy, no. Just in the Spanish reform, no one questioned really the right of monarchy, and no one questioned the Catholic Church. It's very different from what we might consider to be Enlightenment in France. But it was more social. You know, a pivotal point was education. and education for the masses, and to try and transform the larger level of society, to take them away from viewing the bullfights or seeing comedies which the reformers considered bad influences, if you will, to to plays, entertainments that would install healthy living and good morals. In a way, it was a very straight-laced reform that many people might take issue with
today.
It's
kind of wild, Stephanie, to see how deeply Goya was feeling disorder. I mean, as your exhibit is titled Order and Disorder, when we're not even, Genesis, we're not fundamentally challenging crown or cross, monarchy or church. And nevertheless, Goya is, and you can see it reflected in so many of these paintings, he is seeing, feeling, responding to what looks like deep upheaval, things kind of coming apart.
Well, the title of the show was meant to express these two strains going on simultaneously. So in Goya's works, you also see, while you see order, you see strains of disorder. So there's this balance between the two aspects. He reacted in many ways to the violence. He recognized the violence in human nature. So throughout his works, he saw the seeds of violence in human interaction. There, for every happy couple, there are spats and there is brutality as well. So it's a thread throughout his very core of belief. During the war, something else happened. He did not exactly witness the events of the war, but he reacted to them by issuing this series called The Disasters of War. The paintings, the 2nd and 3rd of May, did not come along until after the war, and they commemorate the events in the Spanish mind set the war off, or set at least the violence off. In Madrid.
Such powerful representations of a response to that. I mean, Janice, when we say the war here, we're talking Napoleonic Wars, we're talking the French coming into Spain, in fact, installing Napoleon's brother Joseph as the king of Spain, and lots of upheaval, fighting, execution in his Disasters of War series, all kinds of kind of unspeakable cruelty and torture, a little bit too resonant in our time of ISIS and beheadings in the desert, Janice.
Very much so. Those etchings, though, and you see it in Boston, there are some small paintings he did even before he began those etchings of an assault on a military camp, on vagabonds in the cave, that might be related in theme to the war, but it's tentative. So he was imagining themes of cruelty. He was imagining themes of violence against women before the war. So when the war came along, let's remember that Goya was, approaching 70 years of age. He was living in Madrid. He didn't witness these things. He may have heard accounts. One assumes he heard accounts, but certainly he didn't read accounts because Madrid itself was under Napoleonic occupation and the press was extremely highly censored. So when we look at the disasters of war, these are, many of them are products of Goya's, what he called invention, his creativity, his ability to imagine scenes. So much so that, we mistake them for anticipating photojournalism when no, I mean, they are creative works. And if there's one part in the series of the disasters of war that he might have witnessed, those are the scenes having to do with the famine in Madrid. Because both armies, Spanish and French, were ravaging the countryside in Spain at this time, this war devastated the Iberian Peninsula. Many people took refuge in the city, where actually Joseph Bonaparte as king was trying to find the resource to feed these people. And those images are extremely haunting today. As you've mentioned, we see not only disaster and violence, but those heart-wrenching images of refugees in so many places in the world right now, left homeless, left starving, left without resources. So, again,
and more than homeless and starving, the beheadings and all the rest, the you know, half-naked mm-hmm. soldiers march through the desert. He may not have witnessed these things himself, but surely in a time of invasion, atrocity, battling armies across the Iberian Peninsula, he must have heard tales of the kind of cruelty that we see in these paintings. Invention, no doubt, but in a time where these things were going on, is that the presumption?
Well, we assume that he did. And yet I wonder, you know, as a man who is deaf, as a man who is somewhat removed society because of his deafness since the 1790s, as a man who living in Madrid with a censored press, yes, some news must have arrived. But how, I don't think is something that we can see that we can know well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Spanish master, painter, printmaker of war and upheaval, our dark side, Francisco Goya. He's relevant again right now. Stephanie Stepanek joins us, curator of prints and drawings at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and co-curator of the new exhibit there, Goya Order and Disorder, the largest Goya retrospective in the U.S. in 25 years, but hardly the only attention being paid to Goya right now, whether it's in Dallas or in London. Around the world, Goya is having a kind of resurgence of interest. It may be the headlines, the gruesome headlines, from so many fronts in the news. Janice Tomlinson joins us. She's director of the University Museums at the University of Delaware, author of From El Greco to Goya and Francisco Goya y Lucientes, biographer, historian of Goya. Janice, Stephanie, stand by. Lots of callers already here. Patty in Spokane, Washington. Patty, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. There's a really great Spanish film with English subtitles called Goya in Bordeaux. It's a film by Carlos Saura. It came out, I think, in 1999.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely stunning cinematography. It recreates the life of Goya, all of his paintings in live action. Just absolutely beautiful film.
Of course, he dies in Bordeaux. He's there late in life and maybe earlier as well. What did you take from it about his view of the world and how he saw the cruelties that he conveyed in his work?
Well, for me, the film is just so, I mean, you can feel everything, the energy, the cruelty, everything in the paintings. When you see them in a museum, I've seen them in Madrid,
mm-hmm.
but if you see them in the movie, because it's live action recreated with stunning colors, like the colors he used, you just can feel everything through his life, and it's recreated through his life. It's like a time machine. I really recommend it.
Goya in Bordeaux. Patty in Spokane, thanks for the recommendation. I mean, the paintings themselves just breathe with this artist's invention and overheard observation, if we can call it that, of his times. Will in Troy, Alabama. Will, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hello, ladies.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, I was hearing about Goya, he basically said what's going on with man is no more than man's inhumanity to man, class divide between the rich and the poor, who controls what and what their purpose and what they subjugate other people so they can implement their policies and their way of thinking onto others. And when you have such things as what Goya depicted, it tells you that what goes on today, everything from the Civil War, World War One, World War Two, the war in the Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, what's going on right now in the Middle East and everything. It's man's war against himself and others. We're no more than fighting amongst ourselves for something that's over resources that we should always share with each other, but you won't see that because it's not what we interpret it and how it should be.
Well, we've got it. The guns come out. The heads sometimes come off. Stephanie, you've paid such attention to these paintings and prints. What do you think? What do you say Goya is looking to convey here? Is he trying to warn humanity away from this? Is he just resonating to these dark themes in his mind or the facts of his time?
I think the call expressed things very well and it speaks to the relevance of Goya all the time. We are never seen to be without war and injustice, and Goya strikes that chord in all of us. In his own time, he was also speaking to a wish to express what had never been expressed before. Based on keen observation of human beings, he used his imagination to create new meaning and new images that had never been seen before.
Like what? I mean, I see a kind of, he can paint those formal portraits and did of aristocrats and kings, but even there he seems to take some liberties. There's a little more, a very broad word would be a kind of a casualness that comes in sometimes, and with that a sense of impishness or playfulness that can turn and capture very difficult, dark sensations as well.
That's true. For the Spanish, I think there's a certain elegance and dignity and wish to not be quite known, yet Goya is able to penetrate psychological truth as well.
Get past that mask of propriety.
Yes, yes. Yet still projecting propriety, because these were paintings that would be in people's homes for posterity.
Grand homes.
Grand
and they were paying
homes,
for these.
And he loved to paint what they wore, yet that never dominated the image. It always drew your attention to the face of the individuals and the uniqueness of that particular person.
We have these bright colors and bright scenes, whether they're the preliminary paintings that he did for tapestries to be made from, or in the homes of the aristocrats. When do the darker themes begin to show up, and where do they first begin to show up in Goya's work, the darker colors?
Halfway through Goya's life, in 1792, he was beset by a series of illnesses. We don't know exactly what happened there. There are many theories. The latest one, it seems to be that he, in response to certain viruses or bacterial infections, he might have taken too much quinine. But that, I'm just throwing that out, that's only a theory.
Okay.
But the result was that he became deaf. And at this, and it was also midlife, and he perhaps suffered a midlife crisis, and he decided, I'm not going to do these. I'm not going to subject myself to the requirements of others. I don't want to work on these tapestry cartoons. I don't want to paint according to commission, although he still did portraits. He said, I'm going to rely on my own invention, my own inspiration. And this also was in response to collectors who were interested in owning works that were the product of the mind of this genius, this inspired genius. So it all comes together midway through his career. In the government, there were upheavals. Ministers were being elevated and then tossed out. He was painter to this court. So he observed it all and responded to it in his own art.
Janice, what's your sense of, at the MFA Boston exhibit, at one point they show a still life of fish, a pile of fish dead, and next to it a pile of humans dead. And there's something so similar in the kind of casual, just thrown array that he shows each in. It's powerful, it's dark. Where does this come from in Goya's experience? Do you see it as a result of a midlife darkening, even depression, or something else related to illness? Is it something in his view of the world? Is it something related to his relationship with Catholicism? How do you interpret it?
Oh, if I can, I'm going to be a little contrary on that one.
Please do.
The still life with Seabream that you mentioned, that in the exhibition is shown with Disasters of War, probably one of the earlier Princey etch from that series of piles of bodies. It's an interesting comparison. But when you look at them closely, you might sort of see that the bodies are etched very finely, etched very convoluted, very tight sort of linear etchings on that beautiful, beautiful etching. The still life, that still life and two others that are in another part of the exhibition, if you look at them, I think if you talk to a painter, they'd say they are just an exercise in capturing the wonderful textures of those fish. I mean, when you pile one fish against another and you show the light glistening on their scales, etc., I don't think those still lives. I don't see them as dark. I mean, yes, they are against a dark background. This is true. But I see them, and they were probably painted during the war years when Goya didn't have other commissions. So, well, he had some commissions, I take that back, mm-hmm. but his commissions dwindled, and the monarchs were certainly not in town. So, you know, and then he is an artist who is compelled to create. If he's not doing a portrait, he has to find something else to do. He goes and he just exercises with these wonderful still lifes, catching the textures of feathers and the the fur of the hares that are in another room, or that wonderful texture of that still life that you mentioned, which is in a way so human. I was looking at it because I was caught by the expressions of the fish, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's almost comic where he has one little eye poking out between the tail fin of one of the fish piled on top of it. So, you know, I think we tend to overdo the dark. I mean, this is a man, if you are dark and depressed, you do not create and continue to create as Goya did, no matter what his circumstances, you know, in drawing, in etching, in painting, it's really quite astounding.
Overdo the dark. I think we'll agree to disagree there. the dark is very powerful. There's a lot of it. I wouldn't quibble on the technical skill for a half an instant here. But when I think of a traditional still life, Stephanie, there's a more sort of stately presentation that we're mm-hmm. accustomed to. And he seems to deliver a deliberate, again, disorder in this pile of fish, which speaks to a kind of, this is not an ordered universe that he's observing. And then it's human bodies, no less disorderly, and they're just kind of tossed quality. Yes, he renders them amazingly, but there seems to be a sense of the tragic or the dark disorder, even in just the presentation, to my eye.
Well, there's nothing delectable about the fish or any of the presentations of the still lifes. They're not decorative the way Melendez 50 years before had done them. So I would agree with that. But Goya does bring forth his consummate skills as a portrait painter, his powers of observation to these. It's just they do have a different mood, and they certainly are not ornaments in the way that traditional still lifes are.
Let's go to Walter in Providence, Rhode Island. Walter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that a few years back, I had the good fortune of living in Madrid, and I used to go to the Prado all the time, and they had this amazing room full of dark Goyas. And I used to just, enjoy looking at those. But one thing I found interesting is that probably the most hideous picture was this one called Saturn Devouring His Son.
Yes.
And it was kind of this ogre-like figure eating a child. I mean, literally, like,
yes.
It's a horrible picture.
It is.
But what I found interesting about it is that in the caption, it said that this had actually been in Goya's dining room. And so I was intrigued that, you know, you would want to eat your dinner while looking at this very disturbing picture. But I was thinking that maybe in some strange way it was life-affirming, you know, I would just be curious to know what, your guest would say about that.
You'd have to have very deeply Spanish Gothic taste to find it life-affirming, I guess. But yes, the black paintings were, in fact, Stephanie, painted on the walls of his home late in life.
Well, there is some question about how much time Goya actually spent there. So it's perhaps hard to imagine him eating in that same room. Yet they still are decorations for the house that he purchased in 1819. Mm-hmm. Those paintings do seem to be a very Spanish sort of response to traditional iconography from the point of view of the violence of the war, but they're haunting in the way that Goya sometimes seems haunted. I also wanted to make the point, some people have felt that he might have been depressed or insane or something like that. And that couldn't be further from the truth. He could not have been as productive as he was throughout his life and suffering any kind of clinical depression, although there was plenty of reason for him to be unhappy.
Give us just a sense from his Disasters of War series. I think it's something like 80 of these. Very, very difficult. Dennis says this is not pre-photojournalism, but it's easy to see why people look at it and imagine that. You've got soldiers and their victims very often here, hanging from trees in their I don't know, nightshirts, brutalized in the most terrible ways, impaled upon the branches, sharp branches of trees. You've got axes and body parts flying around here. Paint a few more pictures, if you would, with words, Stephanie, of what one would see looking at the disasters of war.
Well, you see a rape. You see a man being charged, one of the first in Goya's earliest conception for the series, a man being charged for possessing a knife. You see women taking up arms. You see a woman who has climbed onto a cannon over dead bodies. They are vital and brutal.
People tied to a post for execution, other bodies lying around, just piles of body, much like the fish we talked about earlier here in this Bury Them and Keep Quiet is one of these is named.
They're meditations on death and decay. But one thing that people should know is that the title Disasters of War was not Goya's title. That title was applied by the Academy that printed the series for the first time in 1864, well after Goya was dead. Mm-hmm. The prints were only issued during his time or printed during his time as working proofs. These are very rare, and in the exhibition you'll see a selection from the MFA's famous collection of Goya works on paper. Goya's title, translated, is The Fatal Consequences of Spain's Bloody War Against Napoleon. So he talks, in that title, he talks about fatality. He talks about the consequences of war, not the actions of war, but the consequences of war and how war and violence can demoralize people and humiliate them. And you see all of that. But he's also exposing us to images that have never been seen in close-up before.
This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Spanish master painter, printmaker of War and Upheaval, Our Dark Side, and more, Francisco Goya. He's relevant again right now. Big new exhibit at the MFA in Boston, a kind of Goya wave around the world right now, maybe in response atmospherically to what we've seen again and again of war, and very recently of war and cruelty. Stephanie Stepanik is with us, curator of prints and drawings at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Janice Tomlinson has written for the catalog of their new exhibit, Goya, Order and Disorder. She's with us from the University of Delaware today. David in Louisville, Kentucky. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Thanks for having me on, and great topic. I love Goya. He's just absolutely very impressive. When you look at his works, it just... you soak it up and you feel it. And
yes.
My comment is about, I think he's showing us the shadow side of humanity and that we each have this dark side in us. And he's showing us what can happen if we lose control of it and if we don't address it. For example, waterboarding, when that used to be in the news, what that meant. So that's what I wanted to say. It's just, and his honesty is just in your face. And he's not trying to attack. He's just showing you reality, in my opinion.
David, I so appreciate your call. There's definitely light and dark. He's got plenty of bright paintings, but when he goes dark, he goes very dark. Stephanie, David observes, when we're not careful, if we don't watch out, if we unleash these demons, Of course, he has the famous painting of a man slumped over a table, asleep, dreaming. It's called The Sleep of Reason, produces monsters in English. You have it in your exhibit, and all around him, as reason sleeps, or perhaps as this man dreams, we see owls and bats and dark fluttering. It appears to be that sort of armies of the night fluttering around his head.
Well, that could be a key image for all of Goya. It's quite a complex image, although it does fit into the art historical tradition of the figure of melancholy. It's often understood to be Goya himself. Early versions of that image are more recognizable as artist, but it's one of the caprichos. It's halfway through the caprichos, a set of satirical prints issued in 1799. And what he does with that is place it in the middle of a group of other professions, and he's showing us that even the artist cannot be absolved from folly, from stupidity, from false belief. However, the print does so much more than that, in that its title, of course, suggests to us that we have to be vigilant, always vigilant against dark forces, as well as in Spanish, the word sueño, the title is El Sueño de la Raison Produce mm-hmm. Monstruos. Sueño means dream. Mm-hmm. So this is the artist dreaming. And what is he dreaming but these fantastic creatures of the night? And through dreaming, our imagination is released. And it is Goya's imagination, above all, that we know him for.
Janice, when we use dreaming, it puts a little different spin on it. When we say the sleep of reason, it's very tempting to put it in terms of, course, we had the Enlightenment, the age of reason, and it's too easy to imagine Goya saying, let us not slip away from reason. When we do, all the dark things come up and surge mm-hmm. forth. Does that make sense historically that he might have been thinking that?
I think it does. I think one becomes aware of the thin line between sleep, between controlling your, what we would call today's subconscious, and letting it slide. I think today, if we talk about Goya's relevance today, that awareness of how we can let our minds take us to dark places is something that Goya is very much aware of. And sometimes I've wondered, you know, as Stephanie mentioned, in the early 1790s, Goya went deaf. And I wonder what happens when you begin to witness a world without sound. Mm. And I wonder if that makes it easier to slip into, you know, to a world between waking and sleeping. Mm-hmm. I mean, do we dream with sound, for example, mm-hmm. or does the world as we see it, and as perhaps Goya's vision, as his son in the biography mentioned, that his scrutiny of nature was heightened after as a result of his deafness. Does that lead us to sort of blur the boundaries?
Could the shadows lengthen a little bit when there's not the sound of laughter and horse hooves or whatever you would have heard?
Exactly, exactly. And when you see something open-eyed without sound, and when you close your eyes and you see it in your imagination, does that boundary become a little blurred?
But was he also not, or is this maybe an imposition? When he says the sleep of reason, in Spain, above all, there was a kind of battle, was there not, between the sort of Enlightenment forces and those that wanted to go back to older ways? I mean, he paints the kind of tide of what dark old stories and fears around the edges of reason, it seems to me sometimes, Janice.
Yeah, I think the caller from Louisville also referred to it. I mean, when we try to focus and we try to force our reason, when we try to force a rational way on the right, we realize that it doesn't work. I think it makes us, in trying to force that, I think it makes us more aware of the forces that are working against it.
And yet, if we don't actively exercise reason when we sleep, when we dream, they gain license.
Yeah, they might. And I think the translation of that, only because of the tradition that he's drawing in, mm-hmm. and also because of essays that were published in the newspapers and during the years he was working on those, when mm-hmm. they say sueño, I think it definitely means dream. And it was a point of departure for, in the newspaper, an essayist or in Goya's, to sort of give free rein to these his imagination.
And out it comes, and it's dark, at least there, and in plenty. Vijay in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Vijay, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on. Excellent topic. I'm a fan of Goya's images of war, especially the May the 3rd painting.
Yes.
My comment is this. I believe that what Goya's contribution was is he brought the atrocities of war to a more contemporary audience about contemporary events. I don't think he was the first artist to depict horrors of war. I think, for instance, you could look at a painting by Poussin or Rubens, such as The Rape of the Sabine Women,
yes,
and see the same kinds of atrocities going on. But they were always depicted as classical events or biblical events. What Goya did is he said that these same kinds of atrocities still exist in the modern world. And I think a lot of his contemporaries had kind of sanitized war. You might see a painting by, say, J.M.W. Turner of the Battle of Trafalgar and think, mm-hmm, boy, what a noble endeavor warfare is.
Glorious, glorious, billowing sails and billowing smoke and something glorious, even though you know people are dying.
Absolutely. And so I think Goya's contribution was, he said, no, that the dark side of human nature is not something that we outgrew 2,000 years ago. It is still very much with us. And as you've been commenting, events in the Middle East still clearly bear that hallmark. In fact, it would be very interesting if perhaps one day a painter could depict these events, the events going on in the Middle East. Perhaps there is a need for another Goya for the modern day.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Vijay. Thank you very much. Stephanie, in your curator's terms, what is it that sets these scenes apart from older or even as contemporaries' depictions of war, where there's something of valor and nobility and glory, even though we know, even in The Rape of the Sabine Women, this is tough material, but there's something that it's classical, nevertheless. What is it that Goya's doing here that makes it feel so modern?
Well, with Goya, there are no heroes, or very, very few of them. There are only victims. And it's important when you look at the 3rd of May to also look at the 2nd of May and what has preceded that.
And these are both these scenes of war sort of in the plaza. The 2nd of May, it looks like a slaughter in the streets. The 3rd is the execution, the famous man in his white blouse, arms up.
And the 2nd of May shows the Spanish populace attacking the French soldiers, mm-hmm, who have come in. But the brutality of that attack is quite vicious. They're attacking this horse who looks totally victimized. Mm. You see the castration of the man falling off of the horse. There's a tremendous amount of brutality in that. So the 3rd of May is the reprisal. And yet there is, it's a scene of day versus night, of light and dark in them. But you see the religious fervor in the martyrdom of the soldiers. But in some ways, this is the consequences of their behavior the previous day.
I mean, to me,
it's always about the consequences.
Right now, I can't help, but in the 3rd of May, just over this weekend, we've seen in Ferguson, Missouri, so many people gathered, hands up, don't shoot, hands up, don't shoot. And here, you know, this man with his hands up,
and
but they will shoot.
And the humiliation that they're feeling, the shame.
Yes.
And if you look at the...
there's an appeal on his face.
Yes.
Is there no humanity? Do you not see, mm-hmm, I'm human standing here before you? But also knowing, no, they don't, and no, they won't.
And they
hesitate.
Have not behaved they have behaved with equal brutality.
Just the day before.
Just the day before. So it's very hard to sort out. But these pictures do have to be looked at together. The other thing I'd like to point out, going back to his deafness, if you come to the exhibition or even just look at Goya's works and books, mm-hmm, they're filled with sound.
The sound and the fury you can imagine emanating from these
fury,
scenes.
But the figures are always emoting,
yes,
with their gestures as well as with their mouths. So you almost hear them.
Maybe a nostalgia, a yearning for sound. There in
Goya's powers of observation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very keen.
Still there for him. Yeah. Lyric in Madison, Wisconsin. Lyric, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I am a painter and a printmaker. And going through the educational system, as artists, we're taught that art is for art's sake, not to have quite a useful purpose. But as an artist trying to survive and knowing that technically gifted artists are not saying very much right now with their artwork, and it's really concerning me. Most of the good work I see, there are paintings come up out of South America with the U.S. involvement in drug wars or out of Los Angeles. And my question would be this: how do we as artists paying our taxes for drone wars and water torture or even frack mining, how do we filter this and what is happening with the art world in the United States in concerning this violence that's being reflected in Goya's work that we can learn from?
That is a fascinating question for a working artist right now. Janice, speak to that. An artist who's wondering, art for art's sake, maybe not enough. Let's resonate more with what's going on around Goya style. What do you say, Janice?
That is a wonderful question. And certainly, I mean, there have been artists like Leon Golub, for example, who looked at Goya, who admired Goya, who portrayed, you know, large-scale scenes of atrocity and for, you know, who became known for that. I think one thing we have to know with Goya is these scenes of atrocity were not his bread and butter. His bread and butter were religious paintings.
Right, these were locked away, didn't come out until the Civil War era.
Exactly.
In the U.S.
So because I think, you know, I think artists today, just like Goya, are, you know, dealing with the tastes of their public. And Goya's public was a very conservative public.
And
so,
true.
Please.
And yet, Stephanie, there is a legacy here that was picked up on. I mean, when I look at Picasso's Guernica, I always think Goya. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at these paintings and the sort of arms thrown up, the disarray, almost the appeal to heaven in people's eye or to something. There's an artist who was not afraid to do art for art's sake, but brought a kind of sense of Goya, at least atmospherically, into his own work in Guernica, Stephanie.
Well, I agree. And for Picasso, Goya was a major influence. Although it is interesting that that Picasso himself is active in France, and the Guernica is quite a rare image of a Spanish subject. Mm-hmm. So he's also looking to the 20th century public.
What would you have us learn from these as we look out on our sometimes gothically, ghoulishly violent world today, Stephanie, these works of Goya?
Well, I would like to see how he brought his imagination to bear on subjects that still have relevance always, and not just today, but earlier as well, and still will continue to be, partly because they're prints and they're available in larger number. They were made to be reach numbers of people, although for many reasons, Goya, and we don't know quite what they were, was not able to publish them during his lifetime. But he speaks to us always.
Does he warn us away from this path, or does he accept that it's just part of our darker nature and we have to come to terms?
I think it's both. I also think that he presents images that intrigue us in a way and that make us think constantly. There are puzzles to the images. His captions ask us to contemplate, to look. He says, one can't look, and what does that do but make you want to look? So he makes some of the images are puzzling. People should not be afraid of being stumped by Goya. He draws us in always.
He does, and so deeply and wonderfully. The new exhibit in Boston is titled Goya, Order and Disorder. It's just terrific. You'll see more if you look around the country and around the world these days. Goya, back in our minds, back in our eyes. Stephanie Stepanek is curator of prints and drawings at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Stephanie, thanks again for the tour, and thank you so much for coming in today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it, both experiences.
And Janice Tomlinson, director of University Museums at the University of Delaware. Janice, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Listeners, a wonderful gallery at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.